Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning and welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, to another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, where Jeff McClure will be heard to say,
"It may be probable that something may happen."
So stay tuned, kids.
I've learned not to make promissory statements.
Is that a promissory statement that you've learned it?
Well, you're the chief compliance officer.
Yeah.
Okay. I have learned. That's past tense I've learned, but I can't make any statements about the future. The future is always uncertain.
But you're making a promissory statement about the past.
No.
Yeah, it's promissory. You learned something. Yeah. You say you promise you learned it. I mean, it's not necessarily forbidden to say that you've learned something, but how well did you learn it?
I learned it entirely too well.
If you said, "I've learned not to make promissory statements," but it's a promissory statement, it's kind of like writing a letter that says, "Don't read this sentence." You actually have to read it to know you're not supposed to.
Well, I suppose you're right. I won't argue with you about it, but I don't think statements about what happened in the past, I guess they could be promissory.
Well, I mean, they are promissory.
To think about that for a while.
They're not inappropriately promissory. There we go.
I think what you quoted Yogi Berra on earlier was probably one of the more wise things you could say. I've learned it's very, very difficult to make predictions, particularly when they're about the future.
Yes. I also like his other statement about the future. It's just not what it used to be.
That's true.
And we got another question out here.
We do. A good one.
I haven't read it yet, so go ahead.
John said, in 1980, the Hunt brothers tried to corner the silver market. What controls are in place now that weren't then to prevent someone try to corner another commodity? And the answer is?
Nothing.
Nothing except lawsuits.
Yeah.
The commodities markets are designated by Congress as unregulated.
That's right.
Which is why you'll see on television, if you're tuning to what we consider the wrong channels, promises about the price of gold rising to however many dollars, and you should buy gold right now.
That's a pretty normal advertisement out there.
You can't make such promises about stocks. You can't make such promises about mutual funds or anything else that's regulated securities currency or regulated security, because you can't make promises about the future, but you can say anything you want to about a commodity, which is, by the way, people are treating Bitcoin like it's a commodity, but the SEC is working real hard to say, nope, it ain't a commodity.
Right. And that's a kind of a interesting area. So what is a commodity? Let's kind of flatline that. Let's get that back out. What is a commodity? People talk about commoditization. They talk about having something that is traded out there in the world. What's a commodity? A commodity is basically anything that anybody could make. So dirt is literally a commodity. Silver, gold, anything that you can, you know, lumber, pork bellies. These are commodities. How do you tell somebody they're not allowed to buy more bacon? You can say, we're only allowing 3 packages of bacon being purchased during this thing. Okay, what if you're a big purchaser and you say, I want to buy more bacon for my restaurant? How about if you want to buy more bacon for all your restaurants? Maybe you don't want anybody else to sell bacon. Well, there's no easy law that says you can't buy all the bacon you can find, or all the dirt that you can find, or all the real estate, or all the lumber. Anything that is out there isn't some kind of a concept made by humans. It's an actual physical object made by humans. Falls under different categories. So when I say concept made by humans, what am I talking about? This is kind of comes to the real rub of the SEC and whether or not they should regulate cryptocurrencies. Is there a physical asset, something you can hold? That's one of the first kind of concepts around a commodity. If there's a physical asset, then it's a commodity. If it's a thing that you're just carrying it around, and I don't mean a certificate representing something else. I mean, you're actually holding silver, or you can stick your hand in a barrel of oil and get it all oily, I guess. That is a relatively easy definition. So this concept with a cryptocurrency, what is a cryptocurrency? Well, it's kind of an award token given for doing some work. The work that you do may have been completely unnecessary, or it may have been necessary. You can get into the quibbles and such on what the work is when you're creating a cryptocurrency or encrypting it. You're awarded a token. The token has value. It has value, and it's usable for doing something, maybe. It's maybe usable for encrypting a conversation at some point, or some kind of a communication of some kind. So it's got some use behind it. But is it a commodity? It's not physical. It's derived completely from the human mind. Now we're looking at it more like it's software, like the Windows operating system or the Mac OS. That has a value to it. And when that value is traded, it's not traded as a commodity, it's traded as a service. That falls under completely different sets of tax codes. Now, whether or not it's reasonable for different things to fall under different parts of the tax code is completely irrelevant. I think it's absolutely absurd that we treat gold differently when you make a profit on it than you treat whether or not you made a profit on your automobile. Or then we're going to treat that differently than your primary residence, which is different than your rental residence, which is totally different from the silver that you're owning or the gold, which isn't. So you would say gold is a commodity, but for tax code purposes, it's got its own tax brackets. So the reality is that we pretty much call commodities physical items that may or may not have been made through hard work. You may have just found a nugget of gold accidentally, but it's a physical item. It's really hard to put a cryptocurrency in that category, or a dollar for that matter. It's something that represents something else, and we call those derivatives.
One of the problems with cryptocurrency is they are digital assets, and we really don't have good regulations or laws or rules for trading digital assets. We don't have any, really. We're trying to shoehorn them into something else. Like you said, if you're using a crypto exchange, and in some of the crypto exchanges, when you buy cryptocurrencies on the crypto exchange, boy, that's a mouthful. You're actually buying an interest in the exchange itself, in which case the SEC said, whoa, that's a security transaction. They're trying to squeeze it in there, and they're going to continue to try to squeeze it in there. At some point, probably after the crash, after cryptocurrencies crash, which
again, a 50%
crash isn't enough to cause it. But when enough people get burned and they write their congressperson, then Congress will pass laws saying we need to regulate the cryptocurrency market. So
here's an example. When there was a lot of volatility in the Bitcoin marketplace, lots of sales or buys being done, it limited who could buy or sell. So if you had Bitcoins in your account and you went to sell them, even though this is supposed to be peer-to-peer and a ledger book that's shared by everybody, you still have exchanges, and these exchanges put priorities on first come, first serve, and who's buying and who's selling. But it's an unregulated priority. In the stock market, if you say, I want to sell my stock, and then the best client of that broker comes in and says, I want to sell my stock, he's not allowed, or she, the broker, is not allowed to sell the best client stuff first. It's first come, first serve. That's in the law. You can't put one ahead of another. In options, you can sometimes. In commodities, you pretty much can all the time. When it comes to Bitcoin, this is without a regulated exchange, you're going to have people that are treating it. I mean, you're buying and selling it in stock platforms a lot of cases. When you're making a trade in a cryptocurrency, it's treated very differently than when you're making a trade in a stock platform. You've got all these protections in the stock platform. You are still using exactly the same software, and you click a buy button that looks identical to the stock buy button, but now you're under a completely different set of rules. And that's not well known. is really not well known. People assume that if they're buying on a stock platform, the rules for cryptocurrency purchases don't allow someone to sell to their preferred customer before you if you came first. And this is where the SEC's purview is making a rational, free-flowing marketplace. That's what they've been, because if you get an unfair marketplace, you can't do capitalism properly. So the SEC's job is to say, all right, we got to make sure that we have a fair marketplace so that capitalism works, which means you have to regulate capitalism. I know it's weird. It's like,
But you do.
I mean, you have to regulate murder. You can't let people just go around killing each other. There's some degree of regulation that's necessary in a society.
Like in Texas, we have the what's it called? There's basically a false advertising act that enables you to recover, and it's in civil court able to recover triple damages plus attorney's fees.
The Lemon Laws, yeah.
Not the Lemon Laws.
Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act.
Yeah, Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act. So we're regulating capitalism. And we're saying if you make an outrageous claim in your advertisements,
if you're lying to me when you sell it, it's supposed to be buyer beware. But if you just change the odometer, that's not okay. It's only got 12 miles on it. What did it have 10 minutes ago? Oh, 340,000. But you can just change these numbers and then you get a better price. So that's what we do, right? Well, no, there's a law against that in Texas.
Well, that's regulating capitalism, which is reasonable. There's a balance between regulation and free market ability to move around. And what we call fraudulent activities need to be codified so that everybody doesn't sue everybody every time they lose money on a deal.
Right.
And we need to have those laws in place. Unfortunately, the laws covering cryptocurrencies are very, 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 well, there really aren't any laws covering cryptocurrencies. And they're a different asset class, or different character. They're different from anything we've ever seen before. And as a result, the existing laws don't apply to them very well.
And if you think back to like when the music industry was getting all in a tizzy over the transfer from album sales going from vinyl to CD. And there were all of these intellectual property concerns about the CD being different from the vinyl. And if you owned vinyl, did you have to buy it and see? Well, it's a better quality, so you should buy it in vinyl. And then it went on to MP3. Every time we have new technology, we have to figure out a new way of dealing with it. And we do it. We tend to have a big lag behind when it's introduced and when we actually start doing it. This is why Napster was around for a while, basically making a profit by giving away other people's property. As much as I liked owning Napster and being able to listen to all the music that I wanted, none of the artists were being compensated. And guess what? I can still do that today with them being compensated through any of the streaming services that are available, Spotify or Apple Music, or you just go down the list. So regulating properly is necessary. Overregulating messes up capitalism just as badly as underregulating. And that's what the big debate is about. And this is the thing that why you don't hear us getting deeply philosophical on a Republican standpoint or on a Democrat standpoint, is that we believe that both sides are necessary. Republicans saying get rid of all regulations and Democrats saying regulate everything. You get kind of a balance in the middle. It'd be really nice if we could all just be in the middle and be like, just regulate what's necessary. But we're humans and we don't work that way. We need to have like constant argument to come up with a decent solution.
Well, the Republicans don't actually say, let's get rid of all regulation. They say, let's get rid of all regulation, except for that damages the people who we think are important.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
When you get regulations that protect the people they think are important, and that's both sides have the same attitude. They have a constituency. Whenever regulation is irritating to their constituency, they're against it. Whenever it is supportive of their constituency, they're for it.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. So, and that brings us to emergency measures. So here's an example, and I know this is kind of a segue, but last week, we talked about this last Monday being the first day where the moratorium on evictions and foreclosure on houses that were mortgaged through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac went away. And it was true. Monday was the first day evictions could have happened if you could do them in a day. Because Tuesday, the Centers for Disease Control said, hey, the Delta variant's too high. We're putting in another 60 days. Now, this was directly based on Joe Biden saying, do this. And Joe Biden says he doesn't think it'll stand up in a constitutional court, but he thinks it may be necessary for health or whatever. So it's likely to get lawsuited out. But it's also likely that the lawsuit may take more than 60 days to hear, so it doesn't matter.
Well, there are evictions going on locally rather quickly since Texas lifted its moratorium.
Right.
If the let's say the rental property that you're renting isn't backed by a federally backed guarantee loan of some kind, in other words, if the person just owns the property, they can evict you now in Texas. And if you're behind on your mortgage and it's not a federally guaranteed mortgage, you can be foreclosed on today.
That's been true the whole time in a lot of places. Texas said, wait, stop.
I expect there's going to be an avalanche of this and as we come down the road, and it's going to be twofold. One, a lot of people who have those mortgages, they're making the pay. They have to make the payment on the mortgage even if they're not getting rent.
Yeah.
And they're starting to feel a lot of pain from that. So you're going to see the people, and this is what's really weird. You're going to see the people who own the property that have the renters that are not paying rent getting foreclosed on. And you're also going to see renters getting evicted. At some point, this is all going to release because in many cases, these renters have not been paying rent for several months.
More than several months in a lot of cases, yeah.
Which leads to a big conundrum. There is the thought that the unemployment benefits was keeping people from going back to work. Believe me, if people are looking at losing, being evicted, or being foreclosed on, the fact that they get some unemployment benefits is not keeping them from going back to work. Something else is keeping them from going back to work. And I've been researching the heck out of that, and I appreciate anything that anybody can feed me from outside.
Well, I think this is a part of it. They're in a house that they can't, in essence, they can't get kicked out right now. There's cases where lots of cases of weirdnesses, like a landlord says, this is a 2-year, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal today on this subject. A family said, we're going to give you a 2-year lease. We're going to sell our primary residence. And at the end of the 2 years, we're going to move into that house as our primary residence. Well, the tenant stopped paying rent in April of last year. The 2-year lease came to an end in June. She's still in the house in August of the following year and cannot be removed from the house, not paying rent. While the family that owns the home are now living 40 miles an hour away with relatives because they've sold the house that they were supposed to sell to move into their other house, but they can't get into their other house. So there are some things that they could do. They could refinance that house to something other than Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and then they can foreclose. But refinancing a house when you haven't made payments on it because the rent hasn't been paid is impossible. So they're stuck. And in their case, in the Wall Street Journal, they're owed more than $50,000 in back rent.
Which they're not going to get paid, I'm quite confident.
Yeah, it's gone. But to go to the question you were asking of why is it that, you know, with this going on, why is it that the jobs aren't out there when people are at risk of losing their house? And the answer is that mismatch. The places where the jobs are available are somewhere else. And if they leave the house without a job, right now they don't have to pay rent. If they leave the house without a job and they go to another house somewhere, they have to pay rent. So they have been cemented into their location, even though the jobs have gone somewhere else. And until we get the evictions happening, and I know this sounds cold-blooded and horrible, but when we're talking on a large scale, demographic movements where you have migrational changes in where people are living and working happen, and we're suspending that, and it's good reason to suspend it. We didn't want people running out without a house in the middle of COVID and getting it when you're in the middle of a lockdown. And the Delta variant is scary, but at some point, the pain of this has to be felt. It doesn't go away just because we ignore it. So evictions and foreclosures will take place. That will help to stabilize the employment situation, but there's going to be some big negatives in the meantime.
That's one of those things that could trigger a correction in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. We see the evictions and foreclosures really hit high. We see a bunch of foreclosures where the banks are actually losing money because they say we're never going to get paid on this. But one of the interesting factors here is the banks that are most likely to be affected are already under government conservatorship. These are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So if you're a shareholder of them, which you can be again, you may be about to experience some big negatives.
We'll see. It's one of those things that we just don't know. Speaking of that, we don't want to go. We're halfway through the second hour, and we haven't mentioned the big news of 943,000 net new employees in July.
That's huge.
Now that's after the revision for June, which raised it to 938,000. We have, in the United States, net of layoffs, created 2 million jobs and put people in them in 2 months. Now you only need to create about 150,000 jobs a month in the United States to accommodate the people who are coming into the job market from school. So we are in a recovery. Actually, it's kind of funny. Part of the economy is not in a recovery because it's past recovery. The GDP of the United States is higher than it was before we went into this thing. By some estimates, we're already as high as we would have been had there been no pandemic, which means we're in expansion now, not recovery. On the other hand, we still have about 11 million people out there unemployed who really would like to work, who are looking for work and can't find jobs. Now, a lot of people say a lot of those people aren't really looking for work. I don't know. With the unemployment benefits being cut off after a long period of time, the long-term unemployed numbers are dropping pretty fast, but there's still a lot of people out there unemployed who sincerely would like to have a job. And it's a mismatch. In many cases, it's a skill mismatch. A lot of the open jobs are in low-wage areas. And the people who had higher income jobs who don't have a company to go back to, there's been a lot of bankruptcies along the way. Not an unreasonable number, but there's been a lot of people a lot of companies that have learned to get by with fewer people, and they can't get their higher paying job back, or they're having trouble finding a higher paying job, or they're in a locale where they can no longer afford to live where the higher paying job is. We really won't know all the details to what's going on here and why we have such high unemployment at the same time we have a lot of employers looking for employees until somebody studies this in detail years down the road, which leads me to another subject if I could go on.
Yeah.
We in the economics business, economics profession, I guess, suffer from something pretty bad. It's called lag. The best information we have right now, the best and most accurate information is from July and June and the second quarter. And here we are well into August, and we're still talking about what happened in June and in the second quarter. Berkshire Hathaway, for example, I just reported, had 7% increase annually in earnings from one quarter to the next. And they had about a 20% rise in their stock price during that period of time when the S&P 500 was going up quickly. Well, that was the second quarter of the year, which is over a month behind us now. A lot of the data that we work with, the good, solid data that has been carefully researched and is accurate, is going to be 30 to 90 days old before we know it. In a regularly functioning economy where things move in slow motion, which they normally do, that's great. You get this tremendous sense of exactly where you've been and where you're going, and that's where you're probably still going because of the tremendous momentum in the economy. In the current economy, you're going to see, and in the current market, you're going to see things happen suddenly, unexpectedly, for the simple reason that there are external forces occurring here, namely the COVID Delta variant in this case, that are just happening instantly. And by the way, that's one of the reasons we report on the oil price. Oil prices fluctuate when indexes oil near future prices. They fluctuate directly in accordance to what the oil market is seeing in the economy, and it's an instantaneous return.
Right.
The stock market, on the other hand, fluctuates primarily on what they think is going to happen 6 months to 2 years from now. The bond market is looking even further out and making guesses. And by the way, they sometimes get into big arguments as to what's going to happen between the bond market and the stock market. You have to look at all of those and make your best guess as to what the mass of people think is going to happen. But even the mass of people can be wrong in a situation where nobody predicted the COVID virus and nobody predicted the Delta variant being as severe as it's being. Now we're predicting it as being pretty severe, and it's beginning to have an effect, and we'll see how that works out. Talk about rig counts while you're at it.
Yeah. So Baker Hughes puts out a rig count, and let me see if I've got a couple of
I think it's rigged.
It's a rigged rig count. Looking from a year ago, so North America rig counts, active rig counts. This is Baker Hughes keeps track of these, and some of them are so this is the rotary rig count. This isn't talking about fracking.
You need to tell what you're talking about. This is oil drilling rigs.
Yes, oil drilling rigs. A year ago, there were 294 active rotary rigs in the United States and in Mexico and Canada. So North America. There are now 647. This is more than doubled. When we look Gulf of Mexico, so people think, well, it's everywhere. The Gulf of Mexico, that's, you know, offshore. Last year, there were 12 of them, and this year there's 14 of them.
And so, that's not as high as it could be, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of room to develop in the Gulf of Mexico if the price keeps, you know, goes up tremendously. So the reason why there's only two new ones is because the price, while it's come up quite a lot, it's cheaper to get oil from other places. So inland waters, that's exactly the same number of rig counts as before. Offshore has gone up a bit more on the United States. They went from 2 to 14, but it's really that they just reopened some offshore rigs that had been put offline. So, I mean, I'm talking about a lot of numbers here. Texas is a really easy one. 104 rigs were active a year ago. There's 229 this year. So when you say the prices change instantaneously, these rigs come up online pretty quick too, and they go offline pretty quick when prices change.
One of the things I read in the Wall Street Journal this week that I thought was interesting and accurate is the fracking industry has matured, and it's matured to the point where a lot of people got burned really badly when oil went to negative prices and faced bankruptcy. Most of them didn't go bankrupt, although a number of them did. But once you've stared bankruptcy in the face, savings becomes important all of a sudden. You think, this could happen again to me. So the fracking companies are not going all out drilling new wells all over the place in the Permian Basin and so on like they did the last time around. The prices went up. They're rather hoarding cash to a great degree because they're concerned that the oil prices could crash again. Once maturity... industries go through this, or professions go through this, where you come in, you see this wonderful opportunity, you spend and you borrow and you borrow and you spend and you make a lot of money and everything is going along just fine. Sounds like the market. Then all of a sudden the bottom falls out. And if you survive that, you're kind of like survive. It's a Darwinistic survival of the fittest. The ones who survive it learn and say, in the future, I am not going to be in the position where I don't have enough cash to weather another downturn like the last one we have. So you don't spend all your money, you don't borrow money, you pay off debts, which is going on across the economy right now.
I got to throw a little far side in here in the middle of that, because if the bottom fell out and you evolved from it, then those that remain are all bottomless. Just be aware of that. We have a bunch of evolved bottomless frackers out there.
Well, they would like to be bottomless. They would like to go deeper.
Yeah. So what you're saying is absolutely a massive statement about oil in general, about how we're getting our energy. It looks like you have more to say on the subject.
Well, no, I was going to change the subject to something else similar to it was a segue.
Okay. Let's segue.
The chip industry is fixing itself.
Yes.
There's a lag there too. There's a shortage of chips to do a lot of things because the chip making industry was simply not prepared for the fact that you need to have literally, you know, this is an amazing 20 times the number of computer chips in a car to sell it today that you needed a couple of years ago.
Right.
I was looking at new cars, just idly looking at new cars on the market, and they all are very, very proud of the fact that they have nearly self-driving capabilities, all the upper scale cars and many of the mid-scale cars. And those all take a lot of computer chips. There's really, basically a really, really, really smart computer in there that was a heck of a lot smarter than the one that took us to the moon. And
you mean the Abacus that took us to the moon?
Well, there was actually a computer in there, but there's smarter than the IBM 360s. Your car has more computer in it than existed in the world about 30 years ago.
Right.
If you buy a new car today, and it's almost self-driving, it won't quite self-drive, and you need to pay attention to it. But a lot of the newer cars, the 2021 models and the 2022 models that are coming out, you don't even need to have your hands on the wheel, but you need, if you're not paying attention, it'll go to alert. How it's actually watching your eyes to tell whether you're paying attention to the road. So we have this tremendous upsurge in the number of computer chips it takes to make an automobile. And a lot of people are buying automobiles, and the chip industry had been consolidating. Intel, for example, one of the prime maker of chips, was selling off its chip making industry because the need for new and innovative chips was dying. Now they reverse that now, and now they're buying chip makers and building new factories. But this will fix itself because the price of chips has gone up tremendously. And when that's the thing about a free market system that works so well, when the price goes up, people start building new stuff. One of the indications, though, is that they'll build a lot of new factories, they'll make a lot of new chips, and the prices of chips will crash again, which, by the way, happens just as regularly as it does with oil. Well, regularly, as frequently as it does with oil. But that's one of the things we can feel assured of. There's shortages of a lot of things right now. And that's driving inflation, and it's driving shortages when you go to try to buy things. But it's fixable. And it's fixable in a capitalist system because the fact that we're willing to pay more for these things means that more people will be willing to make them. The fact that we're willing to pay more for a meal means more people will be able to work at a restaurant. We've dined out recently at several places. And although we're probably going to stop now in light of the Delta variant, or at least we're going to slow down, we noticed something. In the low-priced places, they're short on wait staff. In the median-priced places where we prefer to dine out because the food's better, they got plenty of people in there on wait staff, and people are paying high tips. And I talked to the wait staff, and they're just happy as they can be. And the companies are having very flexible schedules. They're bending tremendously to fit their employees, and it's working. And they've raised their wages. That's going on across the board, and that's a wonderful thing about a free enterprise system. It equates to a short burst of inflation, which we're seeing, but it's a good short burst of inflation as opposed to a bad one. In this particular case, and I remember the big inflation rise in the 1970s very, very well, the unions kept raising what they would charge to do exactly the same work. It was no supply and demand issue. It was just a matter of, we want more money. And that would present more money to buy to pay for more things, which made the price of things go up. We're not there anymore. And I think this, by the way, they think this inflation burst will go away and will be settled back down to around something a little above 2% before too long.
I agree.
And it's almost time to do commercials again. You got something else you want to say before we do that?
I think we've got a pretty good stopping spot to go ahead and do some commercials, and we'll be back. If you'd like to join the conversation, our email address in here is Jake or Jeff at tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important messages from our sponsors. So we're going to go ahead and keep talking. We got lots more to talk about. Quick thing. There's the infrastructure bill that's going through Congress right now that is roughly $1 trillion. And when I say roughly $1 trillion, because you can't really ever be exact in any of the numbers going through Congress, it doesn't matter if you think you are, you're not, because it depends on what year you're talking about and what your inflation rates are and all that stuff. So I'm going to say roughly $1 trillion. One of the holdups is taxing on cryptocurrencies. The Biden administration thinks that they could come up with like $28 billion by just going in and auditing the cryptocurrency exchanges. And he's probably right, because anecdotally, I know of a lot of people that are making trades in Bitcoins that haven't a clue how to report it. And the currency exchanges are not sending 1099s, because that's kind of the whole thing. You're anonymous somehow, so you don't have a a social security number associated with your trades. And if that's the case, and the IRS gets involved and says, all right, let's start collecting some of this. So when would you owe money if you owned a Bitcoin? If you bought a Bitcoin and you haven't sold it, you don't owe any money. But if you bought a Bitcoin and then you sold it and you made a bunch of money, you owe taxes on the gains. That is, unless you did it somehow in an IRA account, which is another set of complications, you're not allowed to own cryptocurrencies and IRAs at this point. So this kind of falls in a weird category similar to marijuana, in that there's a bunch of stuff that's against federal law that's going on because the federal law hasn't caught up with the circumstances yet. And on that subject, this is an interesting kind of economic conundrum. Marijuana, it's legal in more than half of the states. It is recreational in more than dozens of the states. And in becoming recreationally legal, they're still not allowed to accept credit cards from the federal banking system to pay for it because it's still a federal crime. So we've just stated that the majority of the United States is breaking federal law, but they're still not allowed to use credit cards doing it, even though it's stately legal, but not country-wise legal. There's some weirdness going on in our time. There's always weirdness happening in any given time period. Like the laws on alcohol are still very strange in the state of Texas, in that you can't drink alcohol or buy alcohol on Sunday mornings. Why is that? Well, there was a really important religious reason for that in the 1930s, but we still follow it. You can't buy beer on Sunday morning. Okay, well, that's a law that's taken a long time to change. When technology changes or culture changes, it takes the law a long time to get caught up. If it ever does, they usually are tweaking the thing long after it's no longer a viable industry. And Douglas North, who's one of our favorite economists of all time, he won the Nobel Prize in the 20th century. And he talks about intellectual property, and he talks about what happens in big socioeconomic collapses and all these other things. But one of the things that he talks about that is vitally important is how quickly technology changes versus how quickly the bureaucracy that regulates technology changes. And he said this very clearly. Technology changes at an exponential speed, while bureaucracy changes at an incremental rate. Sometimes it goes backwards because I don't know how that works, but if you get enough bureaucrats together, the clocks start running backwards. Have you noticed that as well?
Actually, I know time slows down in the vicinity of bureaucrats.
If you get enough of them together, it stops and then starts going the other way. So, you know, they've got
We should work on the physics of that.
You're right. There's got to be physics dissertations in this somewhere. So well, that concept of... Go ahead.
Actually, Einstein once, when asked to explain relativity, he says, when you're in the vicinity of your relatives, time goes slower.
There you go. And that's a great explanation. When you're in the vicinity of a bureaucrat, time goes very much slower. So what does that have to do with what we're talking about? The bureaucracies are what regulate. So taxes... we still need to have roads. We still need to pay for our military. We still need to pay for Social Security and Medicare and the other things that we pay for at the governmental level. If we want to continue to do that, we have to continue to accept tax revenue from the citizens and residents of the country. So this is the constant battle of government has a place, but we don't want it to get out of hand. But we also have new things that are popping up that don't fall under any of the old rules, but should somehow. The fact that we're still regulating cable companies under rules that were made in the 1990s is fascinating to me, because cable companies are not anything like what they were in the 1990s. If we look at how social network companies, and you hear a lot of complaints on both the Democrat side and the Republican side about whether or not they should have immunity from prosecution based on whether somebody else is written on their site or not. Those laws were originally intended for blog sites with newspapers, where a newspaper didn't have to defend the fact that it left the comments open and there's some trolls talking trash on a subject matter that's actually factually represented. So we're using like duct tape in our legal system constantly. I don't think people recognize that. I don't think anybody thinks we have an efficient system. But the amount of duct tape that we have holding things together on any given moment, the tax code, it should actually be called tax codes, because none of it's actually in the same language, because it's been written by, what, 30 some odd Congresses. You had something you wanted to say?
Well, that's just the nature of our system. Our government was set up where it couldn't move quickly. You know, we used to talk about the difference in this, and we used to say it with it as a joke, but the difference between pro and con is the difference between progress and Congress.
Yeah.
Congress moves very slowly.
It's because they're surrounded by bureaucrats. They're in that time warp zone.
We didn't regulate securities until the 1929 market crash, and it still took us 5 years to get a pair of Securities Act together to regulate what went on in the securities trading industry. Until we get a crisis, Congress generally doesn't act. We need a consensus among the American people that something, new laws need to be passed and new things need to be done before we actually can move. Otherwise, it's a continual battle over little things. And in along the way, the regulatory agencies and the Treasury and the other places that try to keep stability in the economy and the Federal Reserve just puts Band-Aids on things. You know, I think there's several areas that need good regulation right now, but I think there's a lot of lobbyists from the industries who keep it from happening. And until we get a crisis generated by one of those areas, we probably won't make a law, which sounds bad on the surface. But in some ways, that's a good thing, because that means Congress is not passing new restrictive laws all the time because somebody thinks they ought to be passed. If you're in a dictatorship, as in China, all it takes is one person decide that we need something heavily regulated, and it gets regulated. Which reminds me, there is one of the big effects that's going on in the emerging markets area right now, and certainly event will affect the whole world marketing system, is there's a major governmental crackdown going on in China. Big corporations listing in the United States have been basically hammered down.
Right. And there's a low scale mercantile warfare happening at the same time, where they are intensely competing against each other for the scraps that are falling down from the government. It's fascinating.
And that, by the way, historically, there's no guarantee that it won't work this time, but historically that has been a recipe for disaster for a government when they gain more central control. But Chairman Xi is well on the way to becoming an emperor. He's already been voted in as dictator for life, in effect. And he is cracking down on the free enterprise system that has propelled China to be one of the second largest economy in the world.
There's a great article this week in the Wall Street Journal that said China is more interested in industry than internet. And that, they are cracking down on very successful companies that are doing things like finance and service-oriented stuff on the internet, and yet giving massive subsidies, even sometimes to the same company, for their ownership in industrial manufacturing facilities. So they're making a very clear statement in China that they're staying away from things like ride sharing and
food delivery
and online banking and all of that stuff. That's government stuff. Stay out of it.
There's basically two big experiments. There's a big experiment going on. One side of it is the United States, where we have pretty much a free market system, despite the fact that we sometimes gripe about the fact that it's not.
Because there's no such thing as free.
But we have the freest market in the world.
Right.
And for instance, the tutoring services, any tutoring service in China, which was a big investment target for people in the United States recently, have been forced to go nonprofit that cost many billions of dollars for U.S. investors. They're going with an experiment of greater centralized control to try to eliminate excesses. We, generally speaking, are allowing the excesses to take place and only deal with them if they become a crisis.
If they become damaging to the other companies around them or to their customers. And we have another question. Philip, thanks. And his question is on buying land. Does land in general appreciate, and would you consider it a good long-term investment? The land is close to urban areas. A simple answer to that is land historically over, especially undeveloped land, over long periods of time tends to average an appreciation that's equal to inflation and taxes. So if you look at what you're paying on property taxes and you put that in a separate column and you put inflation in a separate column, long-term raw land tends to appreciate just to keep up with its value at that given moment. So taxes and inflation come off of it. And it's one of the things to look at is what urban area it's close to. Demographic marketplace research on land is important, especially if you're buying it raw and you want to sell it later at a better price. So as I said before, demographics are really important here. If you're near Austin and you're buying land, you may already be as appreciated as you're going to be. But if you're 20 or 30 miles farther away, you're starting to get into possible 10-year planning for the sale of that property. We're almost out of time. What were you going to say?
Basically, land appreciates according to supply and demand. And if you can anticipate the supply is going to be short and the demand is going to be high for that particular piece of land, then you're probably buying something that will appreciate.
The problem is
you can't generalize and say that a piece of land that's far away from services, far away from internet, far away from anything else is going to appreciate at all.
Right. And we can talk about that more next week because there's a lot of intricacies there. But we're out of time for this week. So if you would like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekends and real live people during the week at
254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We've got a contact form there. You can email us directly, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. On the webpage, we have radio recordings going back lots of years. We've got newsletters going back lots of years. Check back on us. See what we were saying before big drops. Until next week, we really appreciate you listening. This has been The Personal Wealth Coach.